Jacks and Start Daddy Show. Welcome to the Relaxed Back with my dad, John Gifford. Hit it, Dad!
Smart moves.
Absolutely. So we're going back to that one stretch, sitting in a chair. That seated hip stretch is definitely one of the most requested movements that I get from my clients.
Get schooled.
And one of the amazing things is many people aren't aware that according to many studies, there are just as many people with herniated discs who have no pain as those who do. You know, that's one thing.
Take it inside.
Exactly. What a lot of people aren't aware of is that they think they're tense because of a feeling, and usually it's the resistance to the existence of that feeling that makes them tense. And that's important because tension increases muscular pain.
It's all here, right now.
You know, I agree. I mean, maybe talking about pain and tension isn't always exciting, but here's the question. You know, if you wear out your body, where are you going to live? I mean, that's the kind of question we're starting to look at. Okay, well, this is show number 5. This is John Gifford back with the Relaxed Back. I have a few apologies out there. Had a guy, Blair from California, sent email some time ago saying, hey, when are you going to start doing the podcast again? And we've just been kind of busy here. But you know what? I guess just the truth is I just didn't do it. So we're back. And what's kind of cool is we're going to try doing some episodes with Allison, who runs my office. She books my appointments. She does all of our graphic design. She does just about everything. So, Allison, welcome to the Relaxed Back.
Thank you.
Good to have you on board. And we have some other changes. We're doing what's called, if I do this right, we're going to be doing what's called enhanced podcasts. So if you have on your iPod or on your MP3 player or in iTunes, you can click through chapters rather than. So if you want to skip past the intro with my kids, although it is awesome, you get to hear Allison's intro voice there. If you want to skip past that, you can certainly just click through to make it much easier to navigate through the chapters. Basically, how we're going to proceed from here on out as we try to get more regular is I'm going to have the show broken down into segments. We're always going to have try to have a get schooled portion. Get schooled is either learning something about anatomy or a medical term or a condition. Try to bring you up to date on maybe latest research or something that might help you if you're a client or a patient or as a therapist. It might help you in your chosen interest. And then we'll have a smart move portion, which will usually be like an exercise, a stretch, I'm thinking. Could a smart move be anything else? I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a smart move. And then take it inside is going to be looking at anything that might have to do with tension. Because you listen to anything so far by me, you'll know that I'm a strong believer that tension is certainly important to look at. And we can't be tense physically, unless we're tense at some level psychologically, right?
Right.
Yeah, right. And then at the end, we will always try to take a look at one logical fallacy, and we'll go into what those are at the end of this show. But I think it's really important for both therapists and clients, I think just about anybody, to learn some basic logical fallacies about how we think and make decisions, because they can affect tension levels if you're a client. And if you're a therapist, they might lead you down a path that may not be the best for your client if you're making assumptions that really don't have a valid argument for. And as my nephew Luke would say, you're not wrong, but your methodology may be wrong. That's really important. One little change that's going to happen on the notes page is Allison, I was going to ask you, I never talked about this with you. Rather than making on the notes page, I'm trying to make sure that anything we talk about, people can research themselves rather than just take my word for it. But also, I wanted to, rather than giving links to certain articles, what I'm going to do is put keywords for you to search in whatever search engine you use. Because I'm a little concerned that the links might be dead a year down the road, and someone's going to click a link and the article won't be at that site anymore.
Right.
And so what we're going to do is I think we'll have a on the notes page for this. We'll try it and see how it works. Give you keywords to search in whatever search engine you want to use, unless it's something that we have on our site, which is still under construction. If it's on our site, we'll probably put a link. But otherwise, we'll just give you keywords to search in Google, and then you can search it for yourself.
That's a great idea.
That's a great idea. Fantastic. That's why we have Allison here. People agree. That's really good. Okay, so let's move on. What's our first thing we're talking about today, Allison? What's up?
Today you have a Get Schooled segment. You had a question.
Yeah, what's that?
From a gentleman in North Carolina. And the question is, what is drop foot?
Oh, yeah. This North Carolina call. Hey, kudos to Luke out there. Luke is my chess partner, great friend, also happens to be the son of my oldest sister. I'd like to have him his uncle, but he also feels like my uncle. I look up to him. Wise, wise man. And got his lovely wife, April and Charlie, back in there, North Carolina. I won't give your address, Luke. but Luke brought up a comment, which is actually one of the reasons why having Allison part of this now, that I was, I think, last episode or the one before, I was talking about drop foot, and Luke asked me what drop foot is. Now, what that is if you have sciatica, and remember that sciatica really describes, it's a geographic location of pain. It really doesn't always speak to causation because many things can cause sciatica, which typically usually refers to pain radiating from the lower back through the buttocks. It can go down to the hamstring, down the back of the thigh, down into the calf, into the foot. Now, if you have something that they call a motor deficit.
Okay.
Motor deficit, right?
Right.
She's nodding her head. She's got it. She knows all this stuff. Her dad was a surgeon. She knows this deal. Then you have what's called a drop foot. And what happens is there's a part of the sciatic nerve that's called the peroneal portion or the outside of the lower leg. And if your nerve gets pinched by something hard, typically a disc impingement, if it's severe enough, you'll end up with what they call a motor deficit, which means you have a weakness or some inability to use that joint that the muscles are innervated by around a certain joint. And so if you have drop foot, typically that's something that hands-on muscle care, in my experience, has limited use for. You can help with the pain, but in my experience, affecting with the drop foot hasn't made a huge difference. But what's interesting, if you go back to episode 3 on the JAMA, the Journal of American Medical Association article, for a long time, they used to say, you know, that if you had drop foot, you had to get surgery immediately. Otherwise, it would never recover, and you would never regain use of that and have permanent nerve damage. But a lot of the new studies are really calling into question some of those beliefs. So check that out for yourself as well. But drop foot means you can always tell if someone's ever had a severe nerve damage with their sciatic nerve, and maybe they weren't able to get the problem taken care of, or for some reason they never regained impulse for that nerve because they'll slap their foot. It'll slap when they walk because it's the muscle that the anterior tibialis, when you get shin splints,
mm-hmm.
that's the muscle that lifts your foot when you walk. And if you can't do it, your foot will slap on the ground. So that's drop foot. So what's interesting about that is the guy who we had on, who was it I had on?
Jim, I believe.
When Jim was in, he had drop foot, and he couldn't understand. They were giving him an exercise to strengthen those muscles in the front of his lower leg, and he couldn't understand why they weren't working. Well, it's kind of like if you have a toaster and you don't have it plugged in. You can work on the toaster all day long, but the toaster won't work until you plug it in the wall.
Right.
And if you're trying to make the muscles stronger, first, you have to get some innervation to those tissues. So, yeah, probably wouldn't do too much. Got to work with the toaster. All right, what's up? What else going on here?
We have another Get Schooled segment. Blair, who I believe you referenced in the beginning, asked a question about trigger points.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah. Okay, so this goes out in... Blair had asked also on the website that we get more into trigger points, and we will because that's really the main work that I've done for the last 23 or so years. And we'll talk about trigger points a lot in our podcast. Let's just start with basically a trigger point is an irritable spot in the muscle. The only thing I don't like about trigger points is that you can kind of think of trigger points as being, because with their points, you can think of them as being round, but they're really not these round. You want to think of muscle tension and these muscle trigger points more of like cords. But trigger points are sore spots in the muscle. And if you look in Tabor's Medical Dictionary, I think it says an irritable spot in the muscle that when you apply pressure reproduces a pain previously felt.
Would people also see them as like knots when people talk about having knots in their back?
Hey, you're not supposed to ask questions. I am talking. Can you tell I am talking? What was your question?
My question was, a lot of times when people get massages or they'll even sort of self-help work on mm-hmm. them on their backs or wherever, they will discuss having knots in their back. Is that?
Yeah, I think that's right. Most people would see trigger points as knots.
As knots.
Yep, exactly.
Okay.
So, and usually in any therapy that's trying to work with trigger points, the theory, the hypothesis actually, is that those trigger points, those knots are sore because they don't have adequate oxygen flow. And so using deep pressure or massage is a way to increase blood flow into those tissues. Let's try this for a minute. If you're listening here, take your right hand and just make a really tight fist and hold it really, really tight. Allison's doing it here with all of you listeners out now. And then if you take, let's just keep that. I was going to say move the other hand, but let's not do that because they might be driving. So if you just hold that fist really tight, you'll start to see that it starts to feel uncomfortable. And if you try to open your fingers, it's stiff. And one thought is that's due to blood flow. As muscle tissues have lower oxygen levels, they're more susceptible to pain. So really deep bodywork therapies are aimed at trying to, at least those targeted at relieving pain, are geared toward, their intent is trying to increase blood flow and see if that makes a difference with the person's pain. So on the subject of trigger points today, all I'm going to say is the biggest issue I think with trigger points among therapists is that they confuse deep work with aggressive work. And the training I went through with Bonnie Pruden, if you haven't seen it, if you're interested in trigger points, there are two books you should definitely look at. One would be Bonnie Pruden's Pain Erasure. We'll put a link to that on the notes mm-hmm. page. And also you might want to pick up Myofascial Pain and Dysfunction, which are the two books by Janet Travell, who was Kennedy's physician during his White House administration. But Bonnie Pruden really is the for the general public, the first person to do anything extensive on trigger points as well as the exercises to follow up with. But the main thing to remember with trigger points is our first discussion here is that if you're a therapist, my suggestion is there's no point in if the person is screaming and clenching on the table, then most likely those tissues are just going to be irritated. And as a client, you know, there's that tendency to say, I don't care what, you know, a lot of times we get athletes in here and they'll say, I don't care what you do, John, just go as hard as you can. But there's a big difference between aggressive work and assertive work. And so pressure should always be within the pain tolerance of the person. But that's probably the biggest issue I see in terms of being problematic issues that happens with trigger points out there is that therapists use way too much pressure. If the person has to wince, alter their breathing, or tighten another part of their body, it's too much pressure. Yes. Moving right along.
Very good.
How are you feeling over there?
I'm doing all right.
Good,
over here.
Good. She's got her Ohio State sweatshirt on. It's new to her.
New to me. It's inherited. Okay. The next question is you have a piece of a stretch in your intro, I believe. And you have some curious people out there wondering, what stretch?
What is that stretch? Well, that's a seated hip stretch. That is probably the most, and if you listen to Jim on a previous who had the sciatica, probably one of the most helpful exercises that people have done is a move called the seated hip stretch, which we have a link to on our website. Mm-hmm. And we'll keep adding moves on the website. Allison will, because she's the one who does all that. But if I were going to talk you through it, basically, you'd be sitting on a chair. You place one ankle on the knee. and then one hand under the knee that's bent and one hand on the ankle on top of your thigh. I'm sure you can't picture this while I'm saying it right now. But if you follow that move, sitting up tall and bending forward, you'll stretch a little muscle called the piriformis muscle, which can often be a contributor to sciatic-type symptoms, pain down the leg, pain in the hip, pain in the lower back, because the glutes, those muscles in your seat, pull into the lower back. So it's a very, very simple move, and I strongly suggest, in part of your stretching regimen, go to our site and download that PDF of that exercise. It's a great exercise, and that's, in fact, I think why I put it in the intro is because, or alluded to it, is because it is such a beneficial, it's beneficial mm-hmm. stretch. It's probably the most, probably by far the most requested stretch that that we give people.
I would say you can do it in a chair.
You can do it anywhere.
Yeah.
Can do it in a car, can't do it very far. Where's Dr. Seuss when you need him?
Where is Dr. Seuss? Okay, are we moving along?
We're moving along, Allison.
Okay, we're going to take chugga, it inside
chugga,
now.
Ooh, take it inside.
Let's take it inside.
All right.
You talk a lot with your clients about the concept of I'm stressed relating to fear.
Yeah, we talk. That's right. You know, we talked about that, with our last podcast with Jim, mm-hmm. and a lot of people really have, whenever I say, in fact, remember I spoke to that group of psychologists several months ago, and I brought up that concept about stress equals fear. Mm-hmm. There is always one or two people in the room who really are resistant to that mm-hmm. possibility, but mm-hmm. and they really try to heckle me a little bit. But, you know, when they try to think about it, they really start to see that it really is hard to be stressed without being scared. And it wasn't too long ago, about a month ago, I think we were at an event here in Michigan and spoke to about, I think, over 150 people, mm-hmm. dentists, oral yep. surgeons. And I brought up that concept a little bit. And at the end, I had someone come up to me, and he was very clear. And he said, well, you know, I have patients who come in who are scared. And he says, I'm a little angry. He says, and I'm stressed, but I'm not scared of them. And I said, why would you be angry that they're scared? He says, well, he says, because they're going to be, you know, moving around, they're going to be tense. And he says, but I'm angry, I'm stressed about it, but I'm not scared. And I said, well, what concerns you about them moving around? And he said, well, I'm going to cut them. And I said, how do you feel about that? And he says, scares the hell out of me. So it really is important to try to look at. It's been very helpful for a lot of my clients, because usually many of our clients that we see here, I would say, you would say, have a high degree of control over their life in terms of at least financially. They're mm-hmm. usually heads of companies. They run their own companies. They have very high-pressure, high-level jobs. And so for them to say they're scared is really not part of their normal – it's not something they're comfortable saying. They just tend to say, I'm really stressed. But one thing I would challenge you to do maybe for a couple of days is whenever you find yourself saying stressed, at least to yourself, just say to yourself, what am I scared of? Just look at it this way. Say, if this Gifford guy is on to anything, maybe he's not. Maybe he's just a crackpot. But if he's on to anything, what could I be scared about? And again, the reason why that's so important is because pain has a high level of what we call psychological overlay, meaning that, and I just cleared this up recently with a psychiatrist who was in here, who was a client of mine, to get clear up on this definition, that our psychology can largely dictate the level of symptoms that we have, especially with regard to muscle pain. And so anything we can do to get more curious about our experience, not changing it, but just get more curious about it, seems to be really helpful in reducing tension levels. That's something you're going to try for yourself, and I don't know of any data to prove that, but it's something that I've definitely seen over the years, and people seem to come back and say that it really made a difference in their tension level. So, you know, give it a try. Anything about that?
Go ahead. It's interesting. So is it what you're saying that psychological overlay is sort of like if somebody has a debilitating disease or something that's very physically straining, that they will have psychological sort of repercussions because of that. So it's kind of the opposite of that. If you have a very...
You mean like they would be more stressed? They would have more perceived stress or more they would experience more stress because they have that disease?
Well, right. So sometimes they say, like, when you have, you know, a disease that's hard to
deal with.
Right. There are sort of like mental or psychological factors that come with that. So you're saying the opposite. If you have some psychological factors going on, then you will have physical repercussions because of it.
Yeah, although you have to be – that's a good point. One thing that happens, especially when you use the term like psychosomatic, people start thinking that you're making symptoms up.
Right.
But a really good psychosomatic response would be, well, if I knew the right thing to say to Allison right now, I could change blood flow to her cheeks.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe if I knew the right picture to show her, I could make tears come out of her eyes.
Totally.
Right? We could do things with that. We could see physical changes that are brought about by our psychology. So to be very clear, and on this podcast in the future, when we talk about psychosomatic issues or psychological overlay, as we speak about it, we're not talking about people who are making up their symptoms. I believe their symptoms are very real. But they can be affected by their psychology. Now, an example of something that isn't connected with a lot of psychological overlay, a high level of that would be a broken bone.
Mm-hmm.
If you break your arm, chances are your psychology isn't going to make a huge difference. That could be argued, but I don't know any data that really shows it's going to make a huge difference in its in how it heals, the time it heals, or your level of pain. But when you get into things like chronic pain, muscular pain, digestive issues, irritable bowel syndrome, headaches, even allergies, blood pressure, anxiety issues. Those are all have what we call a high level. They can be heavily impacted by our psychology.
Right.
But we'll talk a lot about that. But that's good. That's a good point. Because you do. You know, when you have pain, you have people who are – they have – that brings on a toll. I mean, the people who come in here are very distraught over the pain that they have.
Right, right.
They can't do what they want to do. It affects how they feel their value is as a person. I should be able to do things. This shouldn't bother me. What have I done wrong? Nothing seems to help. And that's a whole nother level of tension and fears that it brings on someone.
Right.
So you had a lot of things going on there. For sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is it time for a logical fallacy?
Dun, 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 dun. Logical fallacy. Okay. Well, basically, a logical fallacy is, it's not really a false principle, but it's a way of, sometimes people think they have good evidence for something based on an argument they use, but when you really dissect that argument, it's really not a good argument. And today's logical fallacy is understanding the difference between causation and correlation. And there are two areas where that's very, very important to know, I think, or two ways. There's many ways, actually. But for therapists, I'll start with therapists. In the holistic movement or the alternative healthcare field, which I would probably be classified as, my colleagues and many of the people that I talk to and see at conferences, you know, they'll say things like, well, you know, I saw someone and, you know, 6 months later they were better, or, but, you know, the placebo rates for any type of intervention for subjective symptoms can be as high as 35%. So the fact that somebody came to see you and they felt better doesn't necessarily mean that it was your methodology that made them better. It may have, but it may not have. Now, why does that matter? Well, I think it really matters because it doesn't matter if they get better. I think what happens is then how will you treat people who don't get better? And this is, I'm talking to therapists right now. And so often what I see in this field is, and it's also happens in traditional medicine that I see as well, where someone doesn't get better, and the patient is made to blame for not getting better. Mm-hmm. I see all these other people, they get better, and you didn't, so there must be a problem with you. And from a rational argument standpoint, that's not enough data, and that can be very dangerous. It would be much more rational to say, you know, they seem to get better with what I did. I don't know if it's what I did or if it was a passage of time. And the person probably doesn't care if they got better, why the reasons were. But it is very, very important that you remember that it may or may not be due to the intervention that you provided. And the other damaging thing that could happen to therapists is if you are using that logical fallacy of misappropriating a causation with correlation, you may not be open to other treatments that may be good for your client, or you may not be open to trying new things because you're in your mind, you already know what works. But I would challenge you to say you may not know what works because you're not really basing it on hard data. You know, when people say, well, you know, I'll hear therapists say, well, if you've got all these knots, then you have to have pain. Well, my wife, Kathy, has a lot of knots, and her muscles are very tender. She rarely, rarely speaks of pain. So it would not be fair to say that everyone who has trigger points and tender areas has pain. It's just not that simple. That's why I think pain is such that's why one of the reasons why we're doing this podcast is just to try to expose people to different ideas that they can check out for themselves.
Right.
Because you just never know. And that's why one thing we tell people here is if you come here and after two or three sessions, if you don't feel significant change, maybe you want to go back to your doctor. Maybe you want to try some other things because, you know, you could come here for 6 months, but chances are many of these pains will get better in 6 months anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not making a difference early on, then you might want to reevaluate and see if there are other things that might be more beneficial. Now, as a patient, the reason why it's important to understand that causation versus correlation, you know, one thing I was just thinking this morning about this when we were going to talk about this is like even in relationships, you could have someone, maybe you go to a party.
Okay.
And someone says, what do you think of my dress? You say, well, Allison would be very political about it. She might say something like, well, looks great on you. But let's say you think you might have slipped up and you might have said, oh, I think I shouldn't have told her that I really didn't like her dress. And then that person doesn't call you for 2 weeks. And normally they would. You might erroneously assume they're not calling me because of what I said about the dress. Well, there may be a connection. There may not be a connection. But if you assume that, you might end up in behaviors of either getting angry, not calling them, thinking, well, why can't I say what I want to say? It can go into this whole long course of really delusional thinking without really trying to find out what the facts are first. Because it can really impact relationships when we attach behaviors that we think we know why someone did something.
Absolutely.
That they're reacting to something. And then you talk to the person later and you say, hey, I was really sorry about saying that about your dress. And they say, what? I thought you loved my dress. Oh, yeah. I did. I really did. Yeah, of course I did. But for patients, you know, where we see that causation versus correlation is people will bend, say they'll come in, they'll say, hey, I went to take my groceries out of the car and my back went out. So I'm sure that's what the problem was. But as I say a lot in my seminars as well, is that, you know, you probably bent over to take your groceries out of your car for many, many times, maybe thousands, and never had a problem. So in terms of statistical relevance, we'd have to look deeper into a cause. That may be what we call a precipitating incident, like something that happened at the time.
Right.
But it doesn't mean the two are related. What's the most clear example of that? I don't know. How about the chicken and the rising of the sun?
Okay. Right?
They appear at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not correlated. Right? They're not caused. Right? The chicken crowing doesn't make the sun rise.
I believe it's a rooster. Oh.
This will be the
first and last.
This was an interesting. This was an interesting thing to have Alice on the show today. I want everyone to say hello and goodbye. It was nice having Alice on the show today. Did you not see the memo I sent this morning? Do not ever correct me. All right. Well, hey, that's our podcast, everybody. You know, you can send us your emails, info@motionwise.com. And we're going to try to be on this weekly from now on. Give us a couple of weeks or so to get our kinks out. But after that, you can expect us to just be professional, tip-top shape in no time. Stay loose, everybody. This is John saying so long. Alice, you going to say goodbye to everybody?
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye. Hey everyone, this is John Gifford, and I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode of The Relax Back. Feel free to email me with your questions or comments. I would love to hear from you. All previous episodes, as well as our contact information, can be found at therelaxedback.com or by searching The Relaxed Back in iTunes. This podcast is sponsored and owned by my company, MotionWise, which is devoted to helping people reduce muscular pain and tension by providing hands-on muscle care, educational trainings, and self-help resources such as my book, The Relaxed Back. Visit MotionWise.com to learn more about our services or to have me speak to your company, convention, or institution. Until next time, stay loose.